All right, we're really excited to welcome Dr. Charles Day to our podcast. Eric and I were both research assistants under Dr. Day when we were wee little medical students a long time ago. So it's been exciting to watch as our journeys have kind of all collided together as we progress through our value-based orthopedic careers. As far as an introduction goes, Dr. Day is a professor of orthopedic surgery at Michigan State University and Wayne State University. He's on faculty as an orthopedic hand surgeon at Henry Ford Health System. He's led a very productive career in academic orthopedics and recently transitioned into a role focusing on value-based specialty care. So this includes a recent promotion as well, being named the System Medical Director of Value-Based Specialty Care at Henry Ford Health, along with his other role as being Chief of Hand Surgery. So today we're going to focus on Charles' work in value-based care and specifically how he's working to take theoretical concepts and put them into real practice. So we're also going to spend some time scrutinizing the famous healthcare value equation and seeing its relevance in today's healthcare world. So first off, Charles, thanks for joining us today. Let's dive right in. Tell me what value-based specialty care means to you.
Thanks. I think, it's a privilege for me to see you guys. And I remember when you guys were as medical students, and just some of the fun we had doing research, clinical research and outcomes research very early on in your careers, mm-hmm. and seeing where you guys are now. I feel like a quote unquote proud papa.
Yeah. You've been absorbed into the family.
Yeah. But, value-based specialty care is something I didn't understand, frankly. And this was a position that was pitched to me about a couple of years ago, two and a half years ago, by Henry Ford Health System. And so at that point, I mean, Henry Ford's even bigger now, but at that point, Henry Ford was $6 or $7 billion in annual revenue, $4.5 billion were in clinical delivery services. And then we were sort of just jumping onto how we were going to differentiate ourselves as a health system from the other health systems in our milieu by focusing on value-based care. And they said, we need somebody in the value-based specialty care space. And my question was, well, what is that, number one? So it's nice that you're asking the question, well, what is it, right? And then how is it relevant to specialists, in particular us orthopedic surgeons, right? So I think that for orthopedic surgeons, it's different than value-based care for primary care physicians, right? Value-based care for primary care physicians is about screening and making sure patients are taking their medications, making sure they're getting their lab values, making sure that they have all of their vaccinations. And so you want to keep them out of the healthcare system other than visits to primary care physicians. That's value-based primary care. Value-based specialty care is what happens when that doesn't necessarily work, meaning they need to see somebody outside of their primary care physician for whatever reason. In our case, it's orthopedic surgery and musculoskeletal issues that can't be handled through whatever is being done at the, at the primary care level. And so when I took on this role, the first thing I said was, different than primary care, the first thing we orthopedic surgeons need is we need to be able to measure the value of one treatment to the value of another treatment option. Whether it's, what's the value of robotic total knee versus non-robotic total knee? What's the value of hyaluronic acid injection versus steroid injection, et cetera, right? While the literature that's been published says a lot about either cost differential or quality differential for these treatment options, there's almost none. None of the literature actually looks at specifically the value of one compared to the other in a formulaic way. And so to me, this is critically important because almost all orthopedic and musculoskeletal innovations are all about something that's more costly. I don't know any innovation in orthopedics that's not as costly. Now, there are certain things, other things that, this is why I love what you guys are doing in your field, because I think that this is an innovation that actually is an innovation that's going to advance patient care, but not to the cost of a surgical intervention or otherwise. So I think that this is the space you guys are in is really critical for where we are in value-based specialty care. So the first thing I did was to sort of dive into the literature using my academic background and do systematic reviews in hand, in total joints, in trauma, and in spine to look for what are very specific papers that compared one treatment option to another using both a cost and a quality component in their formula. So anyways, that's sort of my perspective on value-based specialty care. And we're carrying, you know, in my role, I carry that not just in orthopedics, but also in every other specialty, including transplant, including neurosurgery, heart and vascular, cancer, et cetera.
And you did bring up kind of the work we're doing now, obviously, in Proterra. And I will say that it always confuses other health plan leaders when they hear orthopedic surgeons saying that we're trying to figure out how to innovate by doing less surgery. And so they always kind of comment that this is a very unusual conversation that they're having. But that's an aside. You brought up actually at the tail end of your response, the different specialties, because we're all orthopedic surgeons on this call. So we think of orthopedics, but you brought up other fields like cardiovascular, cardiometabolic, cancer that are important, that are specialties. So as you kind of sit in your health system role, what have been those cost drivers and kind of where they rank? I'm sure it depends on the population, but what are those big cost drivers when it comes to specialty care?
Well, it's so funny when you sort of talk about cost drivers, because one of the first things we looked at was what was the spend per condition? And there was an article published in 2019 that looks at healthcare spend across different conditions and different specialties from the years, if I recall, it was from 2005 or 2006 to 2016. So broken down by difference of specialties. And of course, the highest cost drivers are, you know, they broke it down by, you know, CMS or public payers versus private payers versus out-of-pocket cost. And it's not surprising. Musculoskeletal is right up there. Orthopedic care is right up there. Heart and vascular is right up there. Cancer is right up there. So the typical cost drivers, or what we used to consider the typical the money makers, right, within every health system, they're now flipped in a value-based world to be now the highest cost drivers. So this is where having specialists in this space is really critical.
I'd love to understand from a 10,000-foot view where you're coming from. So these are lofty goals. You know, I've seen you tackle massive problems before, break them down and take them over the finish line. But for this, you're trying to see the different, you know, the cost comparisons, you know, between things like you said, like different types of injections, procedures. So you did the literature reviews, you did the systematic analysis. Then what? What is the strategy? You know, what's the next big pieces that you've done or are yet to do?
Great question, Amy. And this takes, you know, this is sort of what you do with most clinical trials that or any research project we do, right? First, you look at the literature and see what people have published. And what we did was in our systematic review, and those are all sort of impressive. I think there's one that's coming out in Journal of Hand Surgery. We're also submitting the systematic review to Journal of Arthroplasty, the ones on joints. And I think ultimately, I think CORE wants one that's more sort of broad, so we combine all of them. But what we did was, what I was most interested in was, I don't want to reinvent the wheel. If somebody has already come up with a formula that can compare one treatment option to another, let's use that one. Let's use that as the metric that we all should be using. And so that was what we came up with, and what we found was that of over 70 to 80% of all of the actual, so 89 articles out of over 12,000 that we looked at, in terms of when you do a systematic literature PubMed search for value-based care in orthopedics and spine, or those four categories we talked about, there were actually 89 articles. And those 89 articles that compared one treatment option to another, overwhelmingly about 80% of them utilized the formula called the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio. So it's a formula that came up with by Dr. Pearson, who's a primary care physician in Boston, in the mid-1990s, and it's been primarily utilized, not surprisingly, in European countries. And so that they actually, because they're, many of them are single payer systems, they need to evaluate which treatment options they want to cover by the government and by our payer system. And so they use that as a way to calculate, you know, what the value proposition is of any procedure or any cost driver in their health system. And it was just actually the U.S. is the one that's actually the least, the most behind. So that's the next step, right? The next step in that is do the literature search. Now we have a formula. We now have engaged multiple pilots now utilizing that same formula of looking at what's the cost of the intervention. And by the way, cost of the intervention isn't just the cost, isn't just the payer's cost as well. I mean, there's, again, that's the complexity of cost. When you use the word cost, there are actually multiple costs that comes up. And that was something that was a surprise to me, because we also, in our systematic review, looked at what's the prospective cost that people looked at in these papers. But the majority of them were payer's cost. Right. What's the payer paying you for that procedure? Which means that when you use that cost perspective, no matter what you use in the OR, no matter how many people you have in the OR, it makes no difference because you got paid right. The same thing for that procedure. So the cost of that procedure has very little or almost nothing to do with what you actually use and how many people you actually employ to do that index procedure.
Yeah, that's a good point, because the it's like you look at COGS, right? The cost of goods sold, like the cost it is to deliver that care is the cost of the health system for supplying that OR, the turnover, the downtime, whatever it is. But really the societal costs are going to be what's not only from the payer side, the lost time to work and transportation costs, whatever it is to the patient. And so you got to either look at the payer side or the societal cost, but it's not about the cost to deliver the care from the system perspective is what you're saying.
Correct. Well, I'll just say that, you know, in addition to that, what the other component cost you have to consider is what's traditionally seen as value, not value, quality. What has traditionally been quality metrics in orthopedics, readmissions, discharge of skilled nursing facilities, reoperations, complications, those only show up when it's an actual cost, meaning the insurance company paid something for that treatment within 90 days after the index procedure, right? And so actually the traditional way that we've been measuring quality in orthopedics is actually part of the cost equation. So it's the cost of the index procedure plus whatever complication cost came up out of that. What we've expanded upon and what's important about this value formula that Pearson came up with is it's not looking at quality from a cost perspective. It's actually looking at quality from a patient-reported outcome perspective, right? And this is what's, again, this links to the work that you guys have been doing in this space. Patient-reported outcomes, improvement after an index procedure or no procedure is really the primary driver of quality metric from a patient's perspective. And we haven't traditionally been using that. Of course, CMS is mandating that now for total joints, but eventually it's going to expand to other areas. But if you look at the UK, for instance, they've been doing this for at least a decade. They've been collecting Oxford hip scores and knee scores. Every patient in the National Health Services system in the UK has had to fill out patient-reported outcome measures. So they have great data, hip and knee joints, and from a patient's perspective. And that's what this formula employs, is the differential of whether or not patients actually achieved the type of functional improvement that they were looking for from an orthopedic surgical perspective.
Now, one thing that you being a leader at a health system that owns a health plan is that you have, it's a very different animal than if you're working for a provider that did not have the claims data or a payer that did not have the provider data. So a two-part question is how have you been able to kind of actually practically get the data together, right, from the different sources? And a larger level, how has it been sitting at the intersection where there is a payer and a provider really with the same common goal at the end of the day, the same pocket at the end of the day?
Yeah, great question about the data and how you get the data. And this is why having this type of system role for a system is really important, because I told our leadership that if I'm going to do this, I'm going to need access to all the financial data that we have within our system. That means we need access to not just claims data, which is the payer's data or CMS's data, but I also need access to the actual system cost data. And what does it cost for this implant, for us to use this implant? And so all of those things are aggregated. Part of my team, I have a system administrative director, works with me, partners with me in this space, and she and I focuses more on the strategy. We have a dedicated financial analyst that specifically works and is able to pull and has all of the access. He is part of the finance department, but he actually works primarily just with the two of us. And so he's able to pull any either insurance data or system data when it comes to cost. And we have access to all of that to be able to access that. The other thing is, part of my role, I'm based now in the Center for Public Health and Public Policy here at Henry Ford. And so as part of this center, which there are a lot of PhDs in the center, but they have Epic abstractors, three or four of them, that are able to help us with pulling out all of the patient report outcomes data, whether it's, you know, pre-intervention and or post-intervention, and be able to, and we do the analysis on our own by plugging into the formula that we were just talking about.
How receptive have provider colleagues been with thinking about delivery from a value perspective, or is it too early to make that transformation?
Honestly, I think most of us want to do the right thing. Almost every orthopedic surgeon I've spoken to, at least, you know, I think most people, they would never fess up to doing, to wanting to do the wrong thing, right? They would never fess that up, right? But I think that, as you know, when you look at the data, and I remember seeing this data when I was in Boston, and I went to a Blue Cross Blue Shield meeting, and they looked at, hey, what's the rate of, you know, arthroscopic knee debridement for knee arthritis? And it was like the variation was tremendous. It was unbelievable, the variation, the utilization rate per surgeon from a payer's perspective. And so it isn't about necessarily about, and anecdotally, our patient, they'll say, well, they didn't have any complications. They didn't have any readmissions from that arthroscopic debridement. But did they actually get better? Nobody knows. Nobody was actually measuring that, right? And so from a quality perspective, if you're looking at complications alone, you wouldn't pick up anything, right? From the variations of, right? But now with this value formula, when you're actually having to look at pre-intervention patient report outcome versus post, now you can actually see who's actually meeting, you know, the minimal clinical important difference from their patient report outcomes, pre and post intervention. And so I think that by utilizing this, this is really sort of pushing people forward. And of course, you know, this leads to innovations like yours, where without surgery, you might be able to implement patient report outcome changes. Well, that'd be even better, right? Because ultimately, what is the perspective? What is the end goal? What is the end target, right? And traditionally in orthopedics, it's about whether the surgeon feels that we have done right by radiographic changes, right? And less so about patient's perspective, but that's changed, right? At first, it was mostly just for research projects, but now patient report outcomes are now much, much more mainstream. And it's going to get even bigger as the, has a bigger role in the healthcare milieu.
And, you know, you're bringing up the equation on value, and we're going to get to that, actually going to dive in a second. But, you know, when we're thinking about changing behavior, if you look at orthopedic surgeons that have ownership in ambulatory surgery centers, right? Like, they won't approve an anchor if it's got a higher dollar cost, even by $1, compared to another anchor with the same value. And so we as orthopedic surgeons are actually very capable of making decisions based on value-based care, right? If two anchors have the same value on outcomes, but one costs a dollar more, you don't use it, right? If you have ownership on that ASC. But translating that to daily practice when you don't have that financial stake, that's a different story. And so, you know, how far are we? I know you've talked about transforming the incentives for orthopedic surgeons and including these value-based components. How far away do you think we are from doing that? And you know, understanding that a place like Henry Ford will probably be a leader in that because we are an integrated system compared to a private practice. But how far away do you think we're there, and what's it going to take to get surgeons to change that behavior?
Well, there's already multiple studies in other health systems that behavior changes when they see the, when people see the data relative to others, right? And I think that in this case, what we're talking about is actually showing them the actual data, because one of our next projects right now is to see how many, we do about 5,000 total joint replacements in our orthopedic service line. And the question is, of the 5,000 total joints that we're operating on patients for, what percentage of them did not meet MCID, you know, after their surgery? And that right away would be the, and then we can then parcel that out by surgeon. How many of your surgeons, how many of your own patients did not get better after their surgery relative to someone else's? And we have, you know, we have Excel spreadsheets. Like, for instance, like we did the single level lumbar fusion. Mel, you'd be interested in this because this is, you know, right up your alley. But we did, you know, there's a significant cost differential in terms of supplies being used. And but when you look at their patient-reported outcome changes after the surgery, just because you use something more expensive doesn't mean you got a better value, better improvement. Frankly, it was mostly the opposite. And so now you're looking at this data. And then when I show that data, there's a surgeon number of cases, cost of implants used for single level lumbar fusion by that surgeon on the average, right? And then the next one is patient reported outcome improvement pre and post intervention at least 6 months out. And then we did the value calculation. So we can show them.
Well, I was going to say, how do you get around things like when some surgeons say, well, I take care of a sicker population, or I'm giving the patient a better longer-term outcome. I'm restoring their angles and their alignment better. And maybe they are. And maybe that patient has a better 20-year outcome than the other patient. How do you get around these sorts of things?
Well, again, this is where the formula comes in. If you assume that there's a longevity aspect to this, right, a third part of the value formula is length of effectiveness. So there's cost, there's quality, and length of effectiveness. There's actually three components to the incremental cost effectiveness ratio formula. And so that is something that can be brought in to this calculation. To answer your question about surgeons and what they're, you know, they can say those things. And ultimately, the question is, do they believe in patient-reported outcomes, right? You could talk about alignment. You could talk about, right? And so it could, they could disagree. And then and even if they thought that something was more important, there's another quality metric. The quality metric that we utilize, yes, in this case, is patient-reported outcomes. But you can use whatever, anything that's quantifiable. You want to look at alignment? Sure. Okay. If I get a group of, you know, spine surgeons and they all feel that that's the most, of course, that's not what that's certainly not what the patients would say. It's certainly not what the payers would say, right? They don't think that radiographic imaging is the end all and be all for quality metrics. And so they can say those things. Ultimately, I think that because of the emphasis that our government is now placing on patient-reported outcomes, that's going to be the gold standard relative to everything else. Now, length of effectiveness is important, right? Because I think you can say, hey, I can achieve the same quality outcome improvement with a corticosteroid injection for that arthritic knee, and that lasts 3 months, right? And that's significantly cheaper, right, than a total knee. Well, if you put in length of effectiveness, which is part of this equation now, right, length of effect. Now, all of a sudden, well, we have data that shows that there's 90% survival rate of total knee replacement at 20 years, right? And now, but your incremental improvement for your steroid injection, even if they improve the same amount after the injection versus the total knee, that's only 3 months. It lasts only 3 months. There's data that suggests that. So that's there's a 3 month effectiveness. So now, all of a sudden, when you look at if you look at the quality being the same. Same improvement before and afterwards, but the length of effectiveness is, you know, what is that? 1/80th, right? Length of effectiveness is 1/80th, one versus the other. Now you just look at costs, right? So at some point, every time you do injection, it's one. The first injection was 1/80th. The second injection has to be 1/160th. The third injection has to be one, et cetera, right? At some point with this formula, steroid injections are no longer valuable for that knee arthritis relative to a total knee replacement.
So that's, I mean, that's a totally different way to look at things, which does make sense. And, you know, this reminds me, the first research project we did together, this probably would have been in 2005. We were measuring outcomes of seniors with wrist fractures. And we were saying that the x-ray, you know, the old Gartland and Worley, where the surgeon would look at alignment and x-ray findings and union, it didn't matter because, you know, 85-year-old woman with a crooked wrist didn't even care at all that she had that crooked wrist, and she was fine with it just as is. And that was, I mean, I didn't really think, I haven't thought about that in a while, but that was our first kind of foray, at least for me, into like value-based care, that you can get somebody better without a surgery as the same as you would with a surgery. And so like, you know, we've been talking about this formula. So I want to kind of dive into this formula a little bit. So we'll flash this on the screen, but the famous Michael Porter formula, healthcare value equals outcomes plus experience divided by costs. So you've explained this to me really nicely, and maybe you can for everybody else. Like, let's go through that formula because it's a formula that was made out of theory and we adopted as gospel. And as another interesting note, we did a 3-part newsletter on adopting the Porter value to real world. And you wrote me a message saying that, hey, listen, there's more to it than just that formula. So can you walk us through that formula of those components and why it may be more of a theoretical than a real world application potential?
Michael Porter is the one who really brought this concept to you know, mass adoption, right? I think most, but even before Michael Porter got into, I mean, most people would say low cost, high quality. That's great. That's really what that's the definition of value, right? Highest value, lowest cost, right? That's what we always think about. The reality is when you start doing the collections and the numbers, the calculations, it becomes very difficult when the cost is in the denominator. You know, when the cost of the numerator, because the cost is always a positive number. The cost is never a negative number, right? And so the cost, if it's in the denominator, basically it can make it null. And it becomes impossible to calculate in certain situations. That's number one. And number two, there are other iterations of combining cost and, I mean, when we did the systematic review, there were 4 or 5 different formulas that people have used that included, you know, willingness to pay ratios. There are 4 or 5 different formulas. But I think there's a reason why overwhelmingly most people utilize this ICER formula is because number one, it's the most universal. And number two, it doesn't take into account from a, you know, when government payers are trying to figure out how to determine what to cover, what a citizen of that government is willing to pay out of pocket is important. And they have access to that data. For most health systems, we don't have access to data and we can't get a good sort of lead in into that. And so I think that because of two reasons, number one, for calculation reasons, and number two, for reasons of just being able to replicate what we're doing based on other, you know, validated papers and calculations in this area. This is why I recommend the ICER formula, even though it is different than what Michael Porter suggested in its original, what he described, I would say, is not a true formula. It's a concept, right? It's a concept that really needs incorporation of patient experience, quality, and cost into some amalgamation, right? But he didn't really go into actual examples of how one thing compares to something else.
What I love about what you're saying is it's incredibly logical. It's impossible to say, oh, well, that doesn't make sense. You know, right? It's you're taking the concepts, which, like you said, everybody agrees with. You're dealing with groups, like you said, orthopedic surgeons, for example, who all want to do well for the patients. And no one's trying to waste money. Everyone wants to do well. And you're in a very unique, you know, very forward-thinking, you know, institution. And so you're working forward with all these formulas and calculations and turning the lights on and whatnot. But it feels like we as a society are still so far away from true value-based care delivery. Is there even a roadmap to getting to the next level? I mean, I know CMS, you know, CMS is mandating PROMs, and I feel like we keep getting little wins, but it still feels like an insurmountable mountain. So what do you think is next to getting us as a society where we need to be?
Just like anything else, I think it starts at the educational level. We need to educate our providers into these concepts, right? And so, yes, I think educating our current providers is one thing, but educating our next generation is another thing. And so, you know, coming back to my roots of my interest, and this is why you guys both worked with me early on in your career, because I've always had an interest in medical education and research and mentorship, right, for the next generation. And so I've been part of the AAMC as I was a representative on behalf of the American Orthopedic Association to the AAMC Council of Faculty and Societies. And as a result of that intervention and some of the things we've been talking about, we're going to be leading I'll be moderating a panel in the November AAMC meeting on the impact, how faculty members can take advantage of the impact of value-based care on academic health systems. And a couple of things we're going to be talking about is really sort of one of which is going to be the educational curriculum for our medical students and understanding like some of these concepts that we're talking about that needs to percolate throughout their thinking, the way they're thinking about how to take care of patients, and that surgical intervention and especially procedural intervention may not be the only way.
At Henry Ford, right, when we think about these concepts and the education, right, there's a vested interest in everybody moving towards value because Henry Ford is an integrated health system. And, you know, like we talked about in the very beginning, right, if we're spending a lot of money on patient populations that the system's at risk for, then the bottom line actually goes the wrong direction. And so kind of touching upon Mel's point a little bit is like, you know, a lot of our colleagues don't work in integrated health systems. They're either standalone private practices or even systems that are mostly fee-for-service. And even the CMS measures on PROMs, those are hospital level. They're not provider level, group level. It's really about the hospital complying. So how far are we away from getting providers that aren't part of integrated systems to actually kind of get interest in this? Or is that a very, very long bridge away right now?
I don't think it's a very long bridge away, frankly. And I'll tell you why it's not. Because there are financial implications now, right? As you know, I mean, our dollar per RVU just got decreased. And this is true across orthopedics, across our country. Why? Because our payers are decreasing their reimbursements for all of our procedures, right? But what the payers are doing is they're taking away some of the money that used to be in the fee-for-service side, and they're pushing it over to the value-based care side. And they're saying, if you provide value-based care, we're going to give you some number in the wall, so sort of up in the sky. Here's some number we're going to start your patients off of that you're responsible for. And then whatever you spend off of the procedures or whatever treatment you've, if there's some leftover, we're going to share that back with you. That's the concept of value-based care. So that those financial incentives are there now. Now, it's only going to be exaggerated more and more. More and more dollars are going to be shifting from fee-for-service from a payer's perspective into value-based care side. So if you're not, it's almost like you got to, you know, the traditional saying, you got to go to where the puck's going. You don't go to where the puck is now. Well, the puck's already moved, right? The move toward value-based care from a payer's perspective, it's already happened. It's just not as prominent right now, but that will continue. So I think that within about 5 years, there will be, and with, you know, I think it'll be much quicker for us as a health system. In fact, I'm meeting with our system leadership on how to start creating an incentive model for value-based care for specialists. We're already talking about it. It's very, very early stages. We're just thinking about what that would look like, right? But I think right off the bat, you can sort of, you can certainly incentivize on quality. We've always been able to do that. And we just never added anything specific to that with teeth. It was easier it's easier for us to just think about, oh, you're reimbursed for the volume. Volume is easy to count, right? Quality is much more difficult. But we are now, everything is coming together. We have a lot of data. AI is everywhere. And so this is where AI can really help generate, you know, what should be the expected reimbursements for readmission rates for any type of procedure you have based on national data? Now, all of a sudden, you can now have these metrics. And so if you're beyond that, then you get either, you can get penalized for that as a reimbursement or as your incentive pool, or you can have a bonus based on how well you did, right? And so now you add on an incentive system that will actually enhance part of those value-based savings that we just talked about. And if you really were over the target, then some of those cost savings that you get from the value-based care dollars come back to you. And by the way, those are not small dollars. And those proportions are only going to be shifting even more. And again, this is where what you guys have been working on in terms of Proterra Health in the field of musculoskeletal medicine is critical, because it's going to be a significant, you want to improve patient-reported outcomes, you know, without costly interventions. This is where what you guys are working on can really be beneficial. And so there's a lot of cost savings that we can then take back from the payers at the end of the year.
So you're doing a ton of work. You know, Henry Ford's doing a ton of work in this space. But how do you spread the innovation of value-based care to provider groups that are not part of value-based payments? And is there even a roadmap to reach out to bring everyone to the level that you all are at?
So over time, if you're in private practice and you don't want to be part of any value-based care dollars, you don't have to be. But the only pool of money you have access to is fee-for-service, is on the fee-for-service side. You don't have access to this other pool. That it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So you just don't have access to that, right? And so what you're being asked, if you don't join a group, is you're going to have to work harder and harder and harder and harder, right? You're going to have to run the wheel just so much harder, so much faster in order to keep up with the decreasing reimbursements, right? And so my guess is that most private physicians over time, when they start understanding the dollars that are available to them, is they're going to see, well, which one of these groups am I going to sign up with, right? Which one of these CINs am I going to sign up with? Because we're open. At Henry Ford, even if you want to join, there's some criteria, but we want to encourage providers to partner with us, because they also have at-risk life, especially primary care physicians. They'll also have patients that they're responsible for in their value-based care patient portfolio. And so I think that over time, once people understand what is the finances that are at stake, even private physicians will be seeking out for groups to join, not necessarily to be absorbed into the group, but that you would have the possibility of sharing part of the pie that's previously not available to them.
You know, the commentary on consolidation of healthcare and the inability to start a private practice now is probably beyond the scope. But you do bring up a good point, right? Like if you try to contract with insurance, even a typical, you know, commercial payer, I learned this through Proterra that, you know, the network rates are less than Medicare. It's not like it's like 150% Medicare rates for commercial. It's actually less. And if you're a small practice, solo group, you don't have the ability to negotiate. Like they don't, like payers aren't going to care if you're with them or not. And I think that's a sobering fact that it does hamper innovation on the delivery side. And again, that's out of the scope of what we're talking about, but it does bring up the point that that's when the tide's turning. So I think it's a great way you said that. Like, yeah, if you want to keep doing fee-for-service care, the reimbursement is going down, inflation, cost of living is going up, your spending power is going way down, right? Like, double whatever the drop is in reimbursement. And you can play that game and they're just going to keep working harder. And it does force everybody kind of to the middle, which is, again, for better or worse, that's what it is. One of the last couple of questions is, there aren't a lot of orthopedic surgeons focusing on value-based specialty care, because every minute you spend on value-based care is probably less than you'd get paid less than you would if you were doing surgeries or seeing patients. So Have you started to see more orthopedic surgeons get into the concept of value-based care and start doing work in that topic? And what advice do you have for orthopedic surgeons who are interested in this but don't know how to start?
A great question, because I think there's a lot of conceptual stuff that you need to understand in this area. And a lot of things I've been talking about really, for me, took some education on my end. I didn't know any of this stuff. It's a question of, do you need to do that? Do you need to do something? Do you need to learn this? And we've all done it. If you needed to do something, you could do it. And because our ability to do that, we are where we are now. And so I think it's just a matter of over time, as orthopedic surgeons start recognizing the importance of this, it will take time. But, you know, there may be some courses that people will take. I mean, I know the Academy has value-based care committees, et cetera. It doesn't get into the details of the implementation and the operational stuff that I'm talking about. It's much more of a broad overview in terms of conceptually. But I think that I've taken my role here from purely an orthopedic surgeon's perspective, right? I'm standing in the position of an orthopedic surgeon who want to continue to do well for my patients and for my own livelihood. So I think that that's what's gonna continue to drive us. And I think that financial incentives will also dictate a lot of that, because more and more people will now be incentivized to also not just be on the fee-for-service side, but also on the value-based care side.
Appreciate your time. Always good connecting, always good seeing you personally, professionally. But the last question I'd like to ask was, what are you most proud of in your career? And as you reflect on the road ahead, what's next?
I think for me, for my career, I think that what I'm most proud of is actually stuff like that, you know, like my mentorship opportunities with the next generation, and you two being two of the people that I've mentored in my career. And there's many others that I think that's something that's really gratifying for me. I can't put a number to that. And really sort of being able to continue to do the right thing by my own patients. Just the other day, there's a patient that came to me and said, you know, you really changed my life after I replaced her wrist. And that continues to drive a lot of my impetus. When is innovation of value? And when is the right thing for us, the right time to employ these innovations for our patients? And how do we then teach that to the next generation? That continues to drive me, and it has driven me in my career for 20 some odd years now. And my sense is it'll continue to drive me going forward.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for that. I think there's a lot that we discussed that hopefully be of value to those that are listening, and a roadmap for other health systems and payers to follow. And hopefully we'll get some more updates from you as this research gets published. And thank you again for everything.
Great. Take care, guys.